You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Terry Tucker. We talk about cancer and living with a cancer diagnosis. I'm going to be honest that this is an interview that might stick with you for a little bit. For all the good reasons, you guys, for all the good reasons. This is not my first interview about cancer, and usually I'm able to record an interview and then immediately after put together what I want to say for the introduction. For this one, I actually had to take a few minutes and really think about what I wanted to share with you. Terry's outlook and his commitment to living is genuinely infectious. He happens to be a former SWAT team negotiator, which is super cool. You won't be surprised to hear about his intentionality and his story of resilience, but also acceptance. Terry shares honestly about some hard things. Part of Terry's message is his own personal faith, and religion can just be a prickly topic, y'all. Certainly not everyone who listens to the show is religious or has the same religion of origin. And I think that's okay. I really do. One of the things I've had to wrestle with myself as the host of this show is how to do my best to bring a wide variety of beliefs and stories all together under the same umbrella in one place and share them without annoying each and every single individual person. I personally think there's a ton of value and benefit from hearing stories from folks who have just different worldviews than my own. So if his views on that particular topic, which is a teeny tiny part of the interview, don't match your worldview, I just want to throw this out there that maybe just listen to hear from the perspective of how one human being is moving through a personal challenge like this. That being said, this is a good one, guys. I think you're really gonna like it. So let's do it. Terry Tucker, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm glad you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat with me today?
Well, Amy, thanks for having me on. And I am absolutely looking forward to this.
I love it when people show up ready to go. I start all of my interviews asking my guests what part of the world they call home. So share with us where you are.
Well, I've lived all over the United States, but currently live in Denver, Colorado.
I love it there. Love it. Was there over the summer. I live in the tropics. So when I come to Colorado, the weather is hard on me. But that's me, not Colorado. Everybody says if I stayed long enough, I'd get used to it. And I believe them. So in a second, we're going to start the official topic. But I want to ask one more warm-up question, which is, can you share with us, me and the audience, something about a hobby or a passion or something you do for fun, something that's not related to work or family?
Sure. And my guess is probably you've never heard this before, but I'm going to say connecting with
okay.
people. It is something that I absolutely enjoy doing. I've never met a stranger. I always like to know people's why, I guess, in life. There's a professor at the University of Chicago who does this experiment with his students. The idea is you go out and get on a bus, and in three questions, you go deep with somebody. So you get on the bus, sit down next to somebody, you know, hey, how you doing? I'm fine, how are you? Question one. Question two, and I'm just making this up. What do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a doctor. Question three. Have you always wanted to be a doctor? It doesn't matter what they say. They could say, no, I grew up on a farm and I wanted to be a veterinarian, but X, Y, and Z happened. Or my mother was a doctor and she died of breast cancer when she was 40. So I'm honoring her memory by becoming a doctor. Whatever they tell you, now they're telling you their why, their purpose, their mission in life. And that's what I enjoy doing.
I love that. I absolutely love that. I interviewed somebody, the episode is coming out in a couple of days. And he was talking about how one of the things that he has learned to do is to pay attention when he's talking to people. Are they looking for me to listen? Are they looking for me to give them advice, you know, to have the conversation because it takes practice. I guess what I'm saying, like it takes practice to learn to engage with people beyond the surface back and forth.
Yeah. And social media allows us to stay on the surface, you know, and we don't go deep with people. So we don't really, We don't know them. And certainly one of my jobs in life was I was a SWAT hostage negotiator. So that sort of prepared me to kind of delve into people's lives that, as a SWAT negotiator, they're probably having the worst day of their life. Most of the people I talk to are not having the worst day of their lives. So.
I'm fascinated by your experience with that, and we'll talk about it a little bit later. I have been lucky enough to have a little bit of training two separate times from people who were high conflict negotiators. One was SWAT and one was something else. And it is a level of focus and premeditation that is really interesting to learn about, for sure. For sure. But we're not going to talk about that quite yet. What we're going to talk about, the topic of the day, back in 2012, you got a diagnosis. You were diagnosed with cancer. You were told that you had 2 years to live. That was 2012. It's 13 years later, so you lived more than 2 years. So I want to ask you first question. When you think back to that time of the diagnosis, getting those news, could you remember, can you remember and share with us how you felt at the time in just a couple words?
Sure, I was given a death sentence, and I thought, well, how can I turn a death sentence into a life sentence? I really believe that doctors don't know, they don't know you. They know your disease, and I'm not a disease. And so it was really, how can I turn this death sentence into a life sentence in just a few words?
Wow. All right. So before we go too far, I do want to ask, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but do you mind sharing a little bit about the type of cancer and what kind of diagnosis we were talking about?
Sure. So I have a very rare form of melanoma that
Okay.
the bottom of my foot. It's called acral lentiginous melanoma. It's not, most melanoma is you had too much sun exposure and it affects the melan, the pigment in our skin. Mine is this rare form that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands. There's also mucosal melanoma, which appears in your mucous membranes, but still melanoma, your eyes, your nose, your mouth, excuse me, in your eyes. There is also an ocular melanoma that appears in your eyes as well.
Wow. Okay, so that's more than about melanoma. I'm learning about that. I have a funny melanoma story. Some types of melanoma are hereditary. And my mother-in-law, she had a patch of melanoma removed. The important part of this, she's fine. And she was in her 80s when this happened. She's my mother-in-law. We're not actually related. And she came to me over a family dinner and she's like, "You need to tell your doctors about my melanoma diagnosis." And I was like, "Okay." And she's like, "I don't think you're taking this seriously." And I was like, "No, I'm listening to you." And we're going through it and through it. And she's very emotional because it's a big deal and it's a big diagnosis. And I was like, "No, I'm listening. I'm totally listening. I am going to tell the doctors about your diagnosis. But remember, I'm not actually related to you. You are my mother-in-law. And so, like, this is like a situation I'm, for the kids, for your son." But she's like, "Oh, right." And I was like, "I know you love me like a daughter, but like, let's back up." So, all right. So we're talking about melanoma. So we're going to talk mostly about life after diagnosis and treatment, but I want to set this up a little bit with comparison. They said 2 years. Let's talk about your life before the diagnosis. So going back to 2010 or 2000, what was your life like before then so that we can see what changed?
So at the time when I was diagnosed, I was sort of, I had a dual career going. I was a school security consultant on safety issues and things like that. And then I also coached girls' high school basketball. And the diagnosis occurred during basketball season. I had a callus break open on the bottom of my left foot, right below my third toe, and initially didn't think much of it because as a coach, you're on your feet a lot. But after a few weeks of it not healing, I made an appointment to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor friend of mine. He takes an X-ray and he says, "Terry, I think you have a cyst in there and I can cut it out." And Amy, he does. It's just, and he shows it to me, those little gelatin sacs, some white fat in it. That's it. No dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern. But fortunately or unfortunately, he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. And then 2 weeks later, I get the call from him. And as I mentioned, he's a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he's having explaining to me what's going on, the more frightened I'm becoming. Until finally, he just laid it out. He said, "Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years, and I have never seen the form of cancer that you have. It's an incredibly rare form of melanoma." And he suggested I go to MD Anderson Cancer Center to have it treated. And that started my odyssey down this 13-year journey.
Wow. Yeah, that is That is one of the things, like that's one of the things that they're searching for. And when you go to the eye doctor or the dentist, one of the things they're looking for is that specifically. So I live in a sunny place. I live in the tropics and skincare. I don't have a lot of melanin in my skin, but I go to the dermatologist every year and they check. And when you have darker skin, then they're specifically looking for places where you're not tan to check for irregularities. That's I mean definitely the feet, the definite I can absolutely imagine that. You're in the gym, you're wearing the socks, a lot of times you don't pay attention to our feet, and then for it just to come out of nowhere, that must have been quite the shocker. All right, so that's what got you to the doctor, is you thought you had something on your feet. You went to a podiatrist who you knew. And then you were off to the cancer center. And it was a surprise. Who was the first person you told, and how did that go?
My wife, actually, I still remember where, when I got the phone call. As I mentioned, I was a school security consultant, and I was at a FedEx location sending a report to a school that I had just done, and I get the call from the doctor, and I'm like, oh, great, this will be a quick, everything's fine. And I'm sitting there, and we were talking, and I hadn't turned the air conditioning on. And by the time we finished talking, it was only like a 10-minute conversation. The entire car looked like, there were two teenagers making out in the back, or so, it was all fogged over and all that sweat. And so it was like, oh my gosh. So I called my wife first, and she was at work, and it was like, here's the deal. I don't know what this means. I don't know anything about melanoma. And then I called a 95-year-old friend of mine whose daughter was a cancer doctor, an eye cancer doctor at MD Anderson, and his name was Bud. And it's like, but he was my second call. I didn't try to call my daughter at school. I didn't try to, it was Bud, because I knew his daughter was connected to cancer in some way. I needed to learn about this disease and what it meant. And she literally has become the sister that I never had, his daughter for me. And she's kind of my go-to if I've just got a question and can't get a hold of my doctor.
That's amazing. How do you know? So he's significantly older than you or was at the time. And so how did you how, that's amazing that that's the connection that you made and that you were calm enough to reach out and ask for support in that position. What's your, how do you can you share like how you have that connection between you and he?
Yeah, we met at the rec center, or actually the YMCA that was close to our house, and he would come every day, and it was more of a social thing for him than it was working out, and we just got to be friends. And it was he and his daughter, and his daughter wasn't married, his wife had died, so we would invite him over for Thanksgiving, and he was Jewish, but hey, come on over for Christmas dinner and things like, and it was, so we developed that friendship, and he was always there for me. And not in a, well, you should do this, but more of, I'll just listen if you want to talk. And if I don't know the answer, I'll ask, his daughter's name is Jade, I'll ask Jade, see what Jade thinks and things like that. And he was a lifesaver for me at that point.
I think that one of the things, one of the goals of the show, one of the things that I'm trying to do is create an opportunity for those cross-generational connections. I think they're harder to set up recently because and this is a guess, I'm not an expert, but it is harder to find those third spaces, we call them community centers, places where people of a bunch of different age groups hang out. You were working in a school environment, and that's an amazing social connection for people, but we do then create all these connections between people who are our exact same age. Like, okay, I know a bunch of people who are parents of first graders, or I know everybody who's a peer in my high school. And those are great. Those are absolutely great. But every once in a while, it's really, really helpful to think about people who are 10, 20, 30 years older than us that have a bigger group of experience. And I think so that's when I love that you had that experience. And I do that. So you say this was a grim piece of news from your friend, the doctor, but you say that you took that death sentence and you turned it into a life sentence. Tell us more about what you mean when you say that, because that's a really good sound bite, and I bet you it took a little while to come up with it, but tell us more about what that means to you.
Well, when I was first diagnosed, I know I went through all of the stages that we would associate with grief. I mean, first it was denial. My dad and my grandmother Both were dying of different forms of cancer when I graduated from college. So, I graduated from college and spent the first 3.5 years after college living with my mom and dad, helping my mom care for them as they died. And they died within 18 months of each other. So I'm like, all right, my dad dies, my grandmother dies. I'm doing everything right. I'm exercising. I was a college athlete. I'm doing all the things we know to prevent cancer. So first it was denial. I can't possibly have cancer. I've done everything right to prevent this disease. And then it was anger. It was like, I've done everything right to prevent this. How can I possibly have cancer? And then I was 51 years old when our daughter was, or when I was diagnosed, and our daughter was in high school. So then there was sort of a bargaining with God. Hey, could you just let me live long enough to see her graduate from high school? And then I absolutely got down, got depressed, felt sorry for myself. But then I came out the other end and was like, this sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace the suck. I don't like the cards I've been dealt, but I'm gonna have to play these cards to the best of my ability. And that's literally what I've been doing. I'm one of those people that, I don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I absolutely believe in Western traditional medicine, but I also believe in some of the, if it's what you eat and how you meditate and the other things. And I try to put both of those together to give me the best chance of living a productive life. And so it's just been a, how am I going to live, given the fact that, I was a college athlete, I was a SWAT hostage negotiator. I've done things in my life that have prepared me for this. And it's funny because my wife tells this story better than I do. When I was diagnosed, the oncologist pulled her out of the room and said, "Look, I've got to go tell him he's probably going to be dead in 2 years. How is he going to handle that?" And my wife just kind of smirked and said, "Yeah, you go ahead and tell him that. See what he does." It's like, yeah,
Really?
I'm one of those, oh yeah. It's like, you tell me I can't do something, I'll probably find a way to figure out how to do it. So.
It is, and that's a terrific piece of personality, that steadfastness and things like that. This is one of those things, because we do all have that. It's more challenging than some other situations, like run a marathon, climb a mountain, because there is that underlying knowledge that we do all get to the end of the journey of life. And so it's like a circular, iterative, sort of thing, I think. And I have not been through the diagnosis that you have been. I think so, Debbie, so there we go. So this feels like an okay time for me to take a second, speak directly to the audience. Like, so if you're listening to this, if you're watching it on YouTube, I want to invite everybody into the conversation with us. When this is live, if you visit on YouTube or on social media, you'll find discussion questions. And so you can participate and chat with me and with Terry and with other people in the community. So now let's get back to the discussion. It hasn't all been roses and unicorns. You have a terrific outlook, a good sense of acceptance, strong personality, skills, all those things. But you've had some very invasive medical procedures as a part of this process. You shared on your intake form, to cut to the chase, you have lost a foot and a leg. You are a very athletic person. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what kind of support you've had and what that process of making those decisions was like.
Sure. So, I mean, the first thing that happened, even before the leg and the foot went, was my doctors, since there was no therapy other than surgery, they put me on a drug called interferon. And I would take a weekly interferon injection. And the interferon gave me severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after those injections. And I took those weekly injections for almost 5 years. So imagine having a horrible case
Wow.
of flu every week for 5 years. And Amy, there was during that time, I mean, it was probably the only time that I've ever wanted to die.
Yeah.
It was like, look, I am so sick of being sick. Come on, God, just take me out of this. Let my family get on with their life. I felt there were two camps. There was the living and the not dying camp. And I was definitely in the not dying. I wasn't living. I was just literally surviving day to day. I mean, sometimes a good day was I'm going to get out of bed and I'm going to make it to the couch. That was a good day. And so it was 5 years of that. And I was like, God, just let it be over. Let it be done with. But obviously God, and I have a very strong faith in God. God didn't take me out of it, but he certainly gave me the courage to hang in there. And at the end of the interferon therapy, it became so toxic to my body that I ended up in the intensive care unit with a body temperature of 108 degrees, which is usually not compatible with being alive, somehow I survived all that. And I learned then that this is bigger than me. This is something that, and I always say this, I think God is using my infirmity, my malignancy, to show people his love, his mercy, his grace, his peace, and his healing. And so I'm like, yeah, use me. If that's what you want, use me however you want to use me. So interferon happens. I have to stop it because it gets so toxic. I go on an immunotherapy that really does nothing to the cancer at all. And they're like, we're going to have to amputate your foot. And initially it was going to be an above the knee amputation, but I was fortunate to get with a foot specialist and the cancer surgeon, and the two of them worked so that they basically took everything in front of my ankle off and left me my heel and my ankle. So it wasn't as bad as having what they were initially suggesting, which was an above the knee amputation. So that was still learning how to walk again and balance and all that kind of stuff. And then got to a point where my entire lower leg, I had an undiagnosed tumor in my ankle area that grew large enough that it fractured my tibia. And so I was walking around for 2 weeks on a broken leg until they realized your entire lower leg is full of cancer and you have tumors in your lungs. So we're going to have to take your leg off in the middle of COVID. And I remember they were like, you're going to be in the hospital for 10 to 14 days to learn how to function. And it was an above the knee amputation. You're going to be in the hospital for 10 to 14 days. Amy, they sent me home after 48 hours. They're like, go home. I'm like, the pain isn't under control. I don't care. Get out of the hospital. You need to go home. We were not, it's just my wife and I. Our daughter's older was out of the house. And so it was, well, we got to figure this out. How am I going to get around? I mean, we're going to have to rent a wheelchair. We're going to have to do all this kind of stuff. So it was, I don't know, but we're going to figure it out. I mean, it's not going to beat us. We will figure it out. And we did. And so now I am, I've been a guy who's been athletic, kind of like you, done all this stuff his entire life. And now I don't have a left leg and I'm in a wheelchair. And I think the way you try to pair those is when you can't do what you're good at, you do what's important in life. And that's where I am in my life right now.
So the I have a follow-up question on that. So you had this amputation in the surgical wing of the hospital during lockdown, during lockdown. And so the reason they sent you home was because they were trying to keep everybody out of the hospital. It wasn't yet, they weren't sure how to contain it and keep people safe. Is that correct?
So my orthopedic surgeon, I'm in Colorado, so I'm treated at the University of Colorado Hospitals. They have multiple locations. So he suggested that we do the amputation at the Broomfield Hospital. He said they have an ER, but they do not accept COVID patients. If you come in,
Okay.
they move you somewhere else. He said, well, so we'll do the surgery there. He said there's no risk. They've got all the facilities that they need, but they don't have COVID patients there. So keeping you in the hospital for 10 to 14 days made more sense. But the powers that be were like, just get them out of the hospital.
Okay. All right. So very good. And so where you would have done 10 to 14 days of physical rehab and education in the lab where they're teaching you how to use the equipment, they're teaching you about balance, proprioception, all those things, because that's all related to you lost a joint. So all of the balance and movement that you had to figure out, you, your wife at home, and a little bit of
Yeah, pretty much.
YouTube.
Like, how are we going to do this? And we realized that, well, the wheelchair doesn't fit through the bedroom or the bathroom doors. It's too wide.
Oh,
Okay, so
no.
we've got to transition to a walker, to go to the bathroom or to go to bed at night and things like that. So, I mean, we're lucky. We live in a house with a first floor master. So, I don't literally don't move off the first floor. I haven't been upstairs or downstairs in 5 years. So since the amputation, so it's. You figure it out. You adapt. You improvise. How's this going to work and stuff like that? And we were lucky. We had an occupational therapist that I had been working with prior to having the amputation, who was kind enough to say, "Look, your house is on the way home from work. I will stop one night and I will help you. Now that rug is a trip hazard. You got to get rid of that." And thank God for her, because she was definitely an angel in that regard.
That is really lucky. That is really lucky. It is so these adaptive things that we do when you lose mobility or you need assistance, it is the kind of thing that you don't think about until, you know, it comes up. And those of us who have not had to experience it, definitely we should. I think everybody thinks we should be lucky, but if you've ever been in a situation where you're in a you've got somebody who's with a wheelchair or even a stroller or anything that impedes the mobility and you're in a situation you're like, oh my, I don't fit here. Like it's really, really hard. And then the reality of it's for those of us who are not going through it, for you, it's 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You wake up, you go to bed. This becomes life. So I just put it in those things because I think it is hard for those of us. It is very easy for those of us who are able-bodied to forget or to not pay attention or to not be aware of those things. All right. So I do think that most people, myself included, are scared of cancer. It feels scary. It's something that we know is out there. It's invisible. So you pitched talking about making the choice of living after your diagnosis. You also made no lots of other choices in here. And one of them is the choice to share your story because you could have done all of these things and just done them for yourself and your family and never chosen to speak up. And I do want to ask, I was like, what was going through your mind and why did you choose to share the story of your illness, your treatment, your outlook with other people?
Yeah, I am a very, I probably can't tell this, but I'm a very private person. I don't like sharing things about myself.
I would not have guessed that actually, Terry, because you are very outgoing and you shared about the meeting people. Okay, so.
And it's, you know, I like holding things about me close to the vest. I keep that, you know, very close. And so people were saying, you know, hey, you should write a book. You should, you know, get out there and talk, speak your, I'm like, no, I'm not doing any of that. That's not me. But you know, I think you get to a point where, so I'm like, okay, I'll try to start a speaking business. And I did, and then COVID hit. And so a friend of mine reached out and said, hey, would you like to be a guest on my podcast? And I said, sure. What's a podcast? I have no idea. I know it about, and he explained it to me and I'm like, okay, I'll try it. Amy, I was horrible. I was terrible at my first book. I had post-it notes all around the camera. He'd ask me a question. I'd kind of lean in. I'd read one of the post-it notes. I provided zero value to the audience. But then I step back afterwards and I'm like, okay, that was terrible. I did a terrible job. But the first time I drove a car, I wasn't any good at it. I mean, the first time I cooked a meal, I think I burned the water. You know, the first time you can't burn the water, just in case. You know,
You
the
can
first
burn the pot, though. You've probably done
burned
that,
a
right?
pot.
Yeah, you
Yeah.
can burn the pot.
I mean, the first time I studied algebra, I wasn't any good at it, but I liked the medium. And I realized that if I was going to do this, I needed to lay it out. I needed to say, all right, you're going to have to share things that you are not comfortable sharing because, you know, there's a lot of people that can talk the talk, but if you can walk the walk with it, you have credibility and people will want to listen to what you have to say. So that's kind of, it took a lot of get outside my comfort zone to share things that I don't share with people ever. And
Yeah.
that's kind of I felt like what I was supposed to do now.
I can see that. I definitely can see it. All right. So you shared, and we've talked a teeny tiny bit about your professional life in as a coach and SWAT negotiation, which is a very, very cool entry on a biography. It holds its weight. Not a lot of people get to say that. All right. So I've talked to a lot of people about dramatic career shifts, people who have gone from concert violinist to airplane pilots, all kind of things. But this is a big one, SWAT negotiator to public speaker on a very personal story. So what, let's talk about that because you actually brought this up a little bit before. What are some of the skills that you can look back and see did carry through from these previous versions of your life to what you're doing today? Because that's not one that we would say, like SWAT negotiator to author, you know, like, so like, what are some of those things that you can
Sure.
see now?
So, you know, I think one of the big things was, you know, a lot of times we would arrive on scene having no idea why the person had barricaded themselves with a gun and things like that. And so you've got to figure this out. So how do you figure it out? Well, first of all, you've got to be where the people are. I mean, I don't go into a hostage negotiating and say, "Hi, I'm Sergeant Tucker." It's like, "No, hi, I'm Terry. You know,
Right.
what's your name?" "You don't need to know my name." "Okay, what do you want me to call you?" You know, so you start that way. And we used to use what was called tactical empathy. I think you can get rid of the word tactical and just talk about empathy. Help me to understand where you're coming from. Again, the important word there is understand. If I was negotiating with a guy who was, you know, accused of murdering three people, I wasn't going to be, "Oh yeah, totally, yeah, you should have done that." You know, there wasn't going to be an agreement with it. But that understanding leads to trust, and trust leads to hopefully me getting you out safely. So how do you develop trust with another human being, excuse me, who's more than likely having the worst day of their life, and secondly, who you've never met before in your life? You need to understand where they're coming from. And one of the, and I'll never forget this, and I'll give you this, excuse me. We gave us a formula when we first started, and the formula was 7, 38, 55. And it has to do with how we as human beings communicate with each other. So 7% are the words that we use. And think how many times you've said something and been like, "Oh, I wish I hadn't said that," or "I wish I would have said it differently." That's only 7% of how that message comes across. 38% is the tone of voice that you use. Are you talking real fast and you can't wait to tell the people what's going on? Or are you kind of the Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh, like, "Oh, this will never work, and I don't know how this." What's your tone of voice? And then 55%, so more than half of how that message comes across, is your body language and your facial expressions. And the reason they gave us that formula was because if somebody was barricaded with a gun in their house, I was not in the room with them. That would have certainly not been safe for me. So we didn't have the luxury of that 55%. We didn't have the luxury of saying something to someone and see them kind of roll their eyes like, "Oh, what an idiot. I can't believe Terry said that to me." So we had to get good at figuring things out, certainly based on what people were saying, but also what they weren't saying and how they were saying it. So those are several of the things that we learned. I could go on for hours probably about the other things, but
And then
I would.
how did those, so that's, I mean, that's, that taps into the mediation tools and things that people that I've worked with negotiators, with really knowing how to listen and to structure a conversation for moving it forward, right? That's what, like, in a project. But how did that come in handy as you were moving through life after the diagnosis and speaking and figuring out your own new worldview, and writing the book and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, this is somebody who's in crisis. And now I'm in crisis. You
So
know,
it's
now
seeing
I'm in,
yourself as the
yeah,
person in crisis. Okay.
I'm the person, you know, I'm negotiating with myself at the same
Okay.
time that I'm the person being negotiated with. And so
Okay.
it was, you know, how do I feel right now? You know, and I don't want your audience to think that I don't have bad days. I mean, I'm still treated for tumors I have in my lungs. I get down. I cry. I feel sorry for myself. I mean, there's no S on my chest that do not wear a cape and fly around with magical powers. I have bad days. But I find when I have those days, it's getting people to see something beyond where they are right now. You know, so if you're barricaded with a gun, all you see is right now. There's no
Right.
future. There's nothing out there. Same with me. You know, there's no future. Well, there is a future. And I think that's one of the biggest things that's kept me alive, is having something to look forward to. You know, when you're diagnosed, and my doctors are going to hate me for saying this, I look at doctors kind of like bookies, you know, like in Vegas. I know if my doctors,
Was like, listen.
they would kill me. So they look at you based on your age, your overall health, and the stage of your cancer, and they say you're going to live X. But what doctors don't know is that you have a tremendous desire to see your daughter graduate from high school, see your daughter to graduate from college, to walk her down the aisle, to play with your grandkids. And if you have something out there to look forward to, you will more than likely keep yourself going. Conversely, and I've seen this, I've seen people, I know people who doctors have said, "You will die in 2 years." And Amy, literally on the day of that 2 year anniversary, those people die because
Wow.
they believe what that doctor said. I've always wanted my life to be based on the decisions that I made, not on the ones I didn't or that somebody else made for me.
Yeah, and I've seen it the other way too. Like, so my dad had heart disease and he had a clean bill of health. And then very, very quickly, it was like a catastrophic diagnosis. And that was like the reverse of that. It was like, oh my goodness, How can those two pieces of information be true? And it just, and to put it in my words, not yours, for me, I was like, wow, I need to reframe what I think of the information coming from this medical office. Not that it's wrong or it's inaccurate, but like, what is the lens I'm going to use? I actually think that some doctors would actually very much think that your bookie diagnosis is pretty spot on because they're in a very tough spot. They've got a limited amount of data and they're asked to make a prediction. And so I think I like that metaphor actually very, very much. I don't, maybe they will hate it. They'll let us know. So, all right. So in a second, we're going to do the final questions. I want to give you a chance to tell everybody about the book you wrote and where they can find it.
Yeah, so the book is called Sustainable Excellence: 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. Never expected to write a book, never really wanted to write a book, but there were enough people that kept making the overture. You should write a book, you should write a book, you should write a book. So Sustainable Excellence is really a book born out of two conversations I had. One was with a former player that I had coached, that co coached girls' high school basketball and lived in Houston, who had moved to the area in Colorado with her fiance, where my wife and I live. And the four of us had dinner one night. And I remember saying to her after dinner that I was excited that she was living close and I could watch her find and live her purpose. And Amy, she got real quiet for a while. And then she looked at me and she said, "Well, coach, what do you think my purpose is?" I said, "I have absolutely no idea what your purpose is, but that's what your life should be about, finding the reason or the reasons you were put on the face of this earth. And those reasons exist, using your unique gifts and talents and living that reason." That was one conversation. And then I had a young man reach out to me on social media, and he said, "What do you think are the most important things I should learn, not to just be successful in my job or in business, but to be successful in life?" And I didn't want to give him that, get up early, work hard, help out. I'm going to give him sort of the cliches that we already know. So I spent some time taking some notes and eventually kind of had these 10 thoughts, these 10 ideas, these 10 principles. And so I sent them to him. And then I stepped back and I was like, "Well, I got a life story that fits underneath this principle, or I know somebody whose life emulates that principle." So literally during the 4 to 5 month period where I was healing after I had my leg amputated, I sat down at the computer and I built stories, and they're real stories about real people underneath each of the principles. And that's how sustainable excellence came to be.
All right. Well, I mean, sustainable is an important part of that sentence because you can do like, ambitious, you can ambitious excellence, you can do like push the boundaries, which is a really, really popular thing. People would like to hear it. But, sometimes those things are not sustainable. Or they're not sustainable for different people, for sure. So that sounds delightful. So listen, the link for the book is in the show notes, Amazon and bookshop.org. It's also in the email that goes out to the entire subscription list. The easiest way to collect these links is always to be subscribed to the email community because then I just zip it to you in your email box and you can click it. Always the easiest. Always like to recommend it. Do I do? Terry, are you ready for the final three questions?
I am absolutely ready.
I am too. Let's do it. All right. Are you a breakfast eater? And if so, what is your go-to breakfast?
Yes, I am a breakfast eater. I eat the same thing every morning. I have an egg white omelet with veggie bacon, turmeric, and cheddar cheese, and a smoothie that would take me 8 hours to tell you everything that's in it. That's for breakfast every morning.
Every morning. And how long have you been doing that breakfast every morning? A long time?
At least 13 years.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it's antioxidant,
Exactly.
anti-inflammatory fill. So that is delightful. Okay, so would you describe, and this question is going to be like interesting. You can answer it in two stages, like pre-2012 and after. Like, so would you describe yourself when you travel as a light packer, a normal packer, or an overpacker?
Oh, I'm an overpacker. I'm 6 foot 8, so I
Okay.
mean everything I have is big, so shoes and stuff like that. It's like, "Oh, those pair of shoes fit in the suitcase. Darn, I need another suitcase." So yeah, I am totally an overpacker.
There we go. That is 6 foot 8. Your clothes are bigger than
Exactly.
many, many people. It takes up more space. That's definitely when we had all these little kids with their clothes were all very small. So we'd pack all of their clothes into one suitcase, and then the
Right.
adults each needed their own. It was like it's like this makes a difference. Size 2T versus full adult clothes. Huh?
Right.
Different suitcase. So all right. So what is the last movie you saw or TV series that you like binged or watched that you would recommend for other people to watch because it's so much fun?
Boy, I rarely watch television anymore. I mean, I read a lot. What's the last movie I saw? What's the last movie I would recommend?
It can be old. It can be like a something that sticks with you
All
from a long
right,
time
I'll give
ago.
you a, I mean, if you want to see a grown man cry, and I think most grown men would cry at this, but I'm going to give you another one after this. It's Field of Dreams, the
Oh, that's,
baseball. But I'm going to go back to 1972, I believe. It's a movie called Brian's Song. It's
Oh,
about Brian Piccolo and Gale Sayers, who were running backs for the Chicago Bears. Piccolo died of testicular cancer at 26. Great movie. If you don't cry at the end of those and you're a guy, you're lying. I'm telling you right now. So.
What's your okay? So, Field of Dreams, that's a classic. That is a
Oh.
classic movie. I'm trying to think of the. There's so many. One of the things that makes that such a fun movie is it's like, fiction and like
Yeah.
magic, right? And then there's like such good performances, very, very serious, but also like the little one-liners, like, wait a minute, do you, like when they finally begin to see the people, he's like, do you guys see him?
Right. But it's, you know, it's it, for me, it's the end. It's having a catch with your dad, you know. And I think before I die, my bucket list has one thing. I'd like to go there and have a catch with my daughter.
Go to the scene where they have the
Yeah, in
set
Iowa. It's
in Iowa.
a facility in Iowa. Yeah.
That seems like that it should be something you should be able to put together.
I think we'll work on it.
Oh, I love that. All right, that's it. Terry, thank you so much for being an amazing guest today on the show.
Well, Amy, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.